The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. And today we're going to revisit a conversation that I had with Robert K. Massey almost exactly 8 years ago on December 8th, 2011. Robert K. Massey joined me on the telephone, and we were scheduled to do a 30-minute interview. And the book that we were discussing had so much in it, and he was such a wonderful, polite, easygoing guest that during the interview, I asked him, well, can we keep on going? Can we record two interviews? So we did. We recorded two interviews, one right after the other, two 30-minute programs. And I heard that Robert died this past week. And you know that you were someone significant when the New York Times gives you a half-page obituary, as they did with Robert Massey this past week. The headline was, Robert Massey, 90, author, recounted Russian history through eyes of the czars. They write that Robert K. Massey, a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer who wrote gripping, tautly narrated, and immensely popular books on giants of Russian history, died on Monday at his home in Irvington, New York. He was 90. The cause was complications of Alzheimer's disease, said his wife, the literary agent Deborah Carl. In monumental biographies of Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, Tsar Nicholas II and Tsarina, and Alexandra, who were assassinated with their five children and others in 1918, Mr. Massey captivated audiences with detailed accounts that read to many, like engrossing novels. One was even grist for Hollywood, the 1967 film Nicholas and Alexandra was adapted from his book. And he joined me for a long conversation almost 8 years ago. Let's listen now to an adapted version of our conversation from that day with Robert K. Massey. We call it the Best of the Book Nook.
I understand that your interest in Russian history began in a very deeply personal way. Can you tell our listeners how that occurred?
Yes, I can. My oldest child, my son Bob Jr., was born almost 50 years ago with hemophilia, the bleeding disease, which was also a problem for Nicholas II, the last Russian Tsar's only son, Alexei. Mm. And I had a background in history from college and graduate studies, and I was therefore very interested. I didn't know much beyond the simple that the boy had this problem and that Rasputin, the false monk, was involved, et cetera, et cetera. So I was working as a journalist at Newsweek. I started spending my lunch hours at the New York Public Library and reading. And I thought it was not only fascinating, but really unknown. Nobody knew what hemophilia was. Nobody knew how the family had tried to deal with it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I wrote my first book, which was called Nicholas and Alexandra. It was published almost 40 years ago. I'm an old guy, but it was a big success. So I left journalism and started writing books.
And you've gone on to write a number of books, including a few about Russian history. We have books about Peter the Great, the Romanovs, and I'm guessing you probably were saving Catherine because you knew this was going to be such a wonderful project.
Well, yes and no. They proceeded just sort of, fortuitously. After Nicholas and Alexander, I wrote Peter the Great because he was such an astonishing figure, and a great figure in Russian history and also in European history when he brought Russia into Europe. And then I left Russia alone for a while. And then came the discovery of the, I'm sure you remember, the Romanov bones in Siberia. And the question was whether these were the bones. So I became a journalist again and went to Siberia and went to various laboratories where the DNA validity was being established and so forth. And then my publisher and other publishers said, well, Massey seems to want to do Russia again. So they and I decided that that it would be useful and fun and maybe profitable for them to do Catherine. And I was a little bit slow to react. I thought, am I really going to go back into the whole Russian cultural scene and so forth? But I tell you, when I began with her memoirs, she was a brilliant intellectual woman and a great writer. She wrote her own memoirs covering the first half of her life. She wrote them during the second half when she was empress. And they are brilliant. They're colorful, they're precise, they're human. And I can't really say fell in love, but I was enormously attracted by her honesty and the story. And I thought, I am really lucky to have decided to do this.
In case you've just tuned in, Robert K. Massey is our guest. His new biography, Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. One would have never thought that she could have done so much. She came from somewhat humble beginnings for a member of the nobility.
Yes, she did. She was a little German girl, and she was a princess, but in the 18th century, and really for much of Germany's existence, princesses were a dime a dozen. And the princesses of little principalities and grand duchies and electorates and so forth were often became the brides of other European princes, some of which were going to be kings and so forth. And this was what happened to Catherine. She was brought to Russia by Peter the Great's daughter, Empress Elizabeth, to be the mother of an heir. She was going to marry Catherine off to her nephew. And Catherine went to Russia at 14, was married at 16, and then found out that her designated husband, the man she was going to be engaged to and marry, wasn't much of a man and wasn't much of a husband. And she had to put up with all that for many, many years.
And he ultimately became Peter III. He was a very strange fellow, and we learned so much about him. What a bizarre character he was.
Yeah, so bizarre and so strange that one can almost go right around the circle and feel sorry for him. He didn't want to be in Russia. He was brought there by his aunt Elizabeth, the Empress. He was a German prince. He was actually the son of Elizabeth's elder sister, who had died, also the daughter of Peter. So this Peter III, as you said, was Peter the Great's grandson. But he had none of the characteristics, the power, the imagination, the assertiveness of Peter the Great. And Catherine was stuck with him.
And a lot of these potential heirs, these royals, were damaged by their childhoods. He's one. Their son Paul. Well, I guess I use their son Paul loosely.
That's an interesting question you allude to.
Yes, she was the mother, Catherine of Paul. We'll get into the lovers later.
Okay.
I thought the Empress Elizabeth was an amazing person.
Well, she was. There were no evident or available male heirs other than this inadequate Peter. And Elizabeth was on the throne. If I can just divert for a minute, I just wanted to make a very interesting point as to why Russia had four empresses during the 18th century. This was a decision made by Peter the Great, who was all-powerful. And he decided that it wasn't sufficient, it wasn't a good idea, actually, to have only males succeed to the throne, to the sovereign throne, to be the Gosudar, Gosudarina. And he changed the law of succession in the dynasty so that the male or he could name anybody, male or female. And Peter the Great named his wife, the peasant woman who had become his wife and who succeeded on Peter's death, and as Catherine the First. Our Catherine the Great, was actually Catherine the Second. But there were, as a result of this decision by Peter the Great, four Russian empresses during the 18th century. Catherine the Great was the last because her son Paul, with whom she had difficulties back and forth through most of his adult life, when he succeeded as Paul the First, he changed the law back and said only males can succeed. I just thought that was an interesting factor. People wonder why the four empresses and never thereafter.
Paul was a little bit bitter. In case you've just tuned in, Robert Massey has joined us. His new biography is Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling, and revisiting today my interview with Robert K. Massey, who died this past week at the age of 90, and I interviewed him for his biography of Catherine the Great. And I mentioned a little earlier that his book Nicholas and Alexandra was adapted into a film. The book came out in 1967, and then the movie was in 1971, so I might have flipped the book with the year on that one, but it's okay, isn't it? We've got more of this Best of the Book Nook coming up for you right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO with my interview with Robert K. Massey. I actually took two interviews and put them together to make this Best of the Book Nook. We did two interviews about the same book back in 2011, and he died this past week. In his obituary in the New York Times, it was written that he understands plot, fate, as a function of character, the novelist Catherine Harrison wrote of Mr. Massey in reviewing Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. She continued, the narrative perspective he establishes and maintains, a vision tightly aligned with that of his subject, convinces the reader he's not so much looking at Catherine the Great as he is out of her eyes. Mr. Massey reached beyond strict biography. He wrote a book addressing the puzzles that arose after the skeletons of Nicholas and Alexandra, the last royal rulers of Russia, were discovered, along with those of family members in Siberia in the 1990s. He also produced two naval histories of World War I that bristled with drama. During that first segment, he mentioned how he decided to write about Nicholas and Alexandra. And the New York Times describes it. Mr. Massey said his literary odyssey was set in motion by research he did at the New York Public Library during lunch breaks from his job as a young journalist. It was purely personal research at first. He wanted to know more about the bleeding disease of hemophilia and how he and his wife at the time, Suzanne Massey, who became a noted Russian scholar, could help their hemophiliac son, Bob. During his research, he became fascinated with perhaps the most famous childhood case of hemophilia, that of Alexei, a son of Nicholas and Alexandra. It was to help Alexei that Alexandra had summoned Grigory Rasputin, the notorious faith-healing monk who gained influence over the imperial court.
public disdain of Rasputin contributed to the Russian people's turn against the monarchy, helping to pave the way for the Russian Revolution of 1917. He ended up writing about hemophilia for the Saturday Evening Post. And in the interview, he said he was working for Newsweek at the time. So I'm not quite sure which is which, but let's continue now with the Best of the Book Nook and Robert K. Massey, recorded back in 2011.
We have this bizarre marriage where Catherine is essentially married to this guy who sleeps in her bed with her, yet for many years the Empress Elizabeth is waiting for an heir to be born, but there's a problem. A big problem.
There is a problem. It's both a psychological and a physical problem. The result is that, as you said, Catherine and Peter slept in the same bed together for 9 years, and he never touched her. It was a physical problem which made making love painful and difficult for him. He liked women, he chased women, but he never carried through to the the ultimate relationship with a woman until later in his life, after he had sort of abandoned Catherine. Therefore, the Empress Elizabeth had to provide or insist that Catherine produce a child with somebody else. Now, the great, still unanswered historical question is whether Peter, restored to sexual ability and health, came back to Catherine, and together they fathered Paul, I mean they had Paul, and or whether she had a relationship with another young man designated by the Empress to fulfill her objective of producing an heir. And that has never been totally resolved by historians. And you can imagine that Russians are very interested because it brings up the whole question or the decision as to whether the Romanov dynasty continued until the end or whether it was actually the Saltykov dynasty, the other candidate for being the father of Paul was a young man named Sergei Saltykov. And that, I try and lay out all the facts on both sides, or all the assumptions, suppositions, and so forth, and I leave it there for the reader to puzzle over along with everyone else.
The strongest evidence that I could see just as a casual observer was these wonderful portraits that you included, and I must say that Catherine's first lover, the Saltykov gentleman, certainly has a very close facial resemblance to her son, Paul.
Well, people often observe that. They also look at Peter, I don't see this quite as much, and say there's a resemblance there. And the stronger argument on behalf of Peter's paternity is that Paul sort of copied his father in his tastes. He was pro-German. He dressed his guards in German uniforms. He desperately admired Frederick the Great, as his father had. And when he became emperor in 1762, he immediately ended the war that Russia was fighting with Germany and became Frederick the Great's ally, overnight, as it were, which was part of the reason that the Russian army and the Guards regiments helped to overthrow him.
This is fascinating stuff, and there's so much in this book. We have this young woman who is so intelligent and so ambitious, and she puts up with what is essentially a loveless marriage. They're friends for a while, but they grow apart, and he flaunts his lovers in front of her, and they kind of have an arrangement, don't they, where they both overlook the things that are going on between various people in the Corps?
Well, not only overlook. I mean, remember when she took as a lover this handsome Polish diplomat, Stanislaus Poniatowski, Peter accepted him. And they actually, the husband and the wife, each with their own lovers, would have suppers together. It was what the French call a ménage à quatre.
Mm.
And very strange.
Amazing.
But there it was.
Yeah. And the intrigues, when we get into the middle of the book and she is now empress and we find out how that happened, this is just such an amazing story. I think one of my favorite parts about it is Peter was fascinated by fires, and you make the point that Moscow was all these wooden structures and a lot of fires burning all the time. And apparently, Peter III was a fire bug. And this ally of Catherine's started a fire in his own house, knowing that Peter would run to it.
Yes, that was because Catherine was pregnant by her very long-term lover, then Gregory Orlov, a guards officer, and she didn't want anybody to know. She was Peter was the Tsar, and he was very hostile to Catherine by then. He was threatening to divorce her by sending her to a convent. And when she was going to have this baby, she had a faithful retainer servant who thought that the way to get Peter totally out of the palace was to burn his own house down, and that almost certainly the Tsar would rush off to watch, which happened. And this little illegitimate child was born and then hustled out of the palace to be brought up by the family of this retainer. He actually had a successful sort of in not very important life. But that was the kind of thing the people around Catherine admired her greatly. It wasn't just that they disliked and despaired of Peter. They wanted her. She was so intelligent. She came up with such good ideas. And she saved Peter's. She pulled his irons out of the fire a number of times. She was obviously equipped to rule. He was obviously a disaster. And so, as you were saying, this coup d'etat came along almost with the force of nature, of destiny.
I love the portrait of her as the coup is unfolding, and she's in her uniform on her horse. What a legendary picture.
Yeah. She marched out to the suburban palace where Peter was with 14,000 soldiers marching behind her, and he liked to think of himself as a soldier, but his main soldiering was done with toy soldiers or dressed up servants and so forth. And he surrendered immediately. He abdicated on her demand, and then she sent him off to a country house. And I don't know whether you want to go into what happened there or not, but within a week he was dead. And she was the Empress of Russia.
Was Potemkin her real love of her life?
Yes, he was, definitely. And he may well have been. There's strong evidence that he was actually her husband. It would have been a morganatic marriage, that they were quietly married one night. He was an extraordinary man, and she knew this when she met him. But she didn't marry him or even sort of have him become her favorite, which was the term at the Russian court for sort of a designated, publicly recognized lover, for a number of years. He was 10 years younger than she, and he was an army officer. He was fighting the Turks in the Balkans and along the Black Sea coast. And when he came back, there's a good story. He was a brilliant man intellectually as well as a war hero. And she brought him in, or he was brought in, to her intimate circle of 20 or so friends, with whom she could abandon protocol, play games, sort of like charades and so forth, with penalties, and just be Catherine, not Matushka, the mother figure. And Potemkin was brought into this group, and she said, I hear a lot about you. I hear a lot of good things about you. I understand you're a wonderful mimic, and could you demonstrate this? So to the astonishment and concern of all the people there, he immediately mimicked her with her German accent. She spoke French, Russian, and German, and her body language. And the people there, although used to informality, thought this was going much too far and wondered what was going to happen to Colonel Potemkin. And what happened was that Catherine laughed and laughed and laughed. Mm. She thought that this is a special man. Their love letters, once they became intimate, I think you may or may not agree with the level of passion, but I think they sort of scorched the page. I've never read royal love letters of this kind, but it's not just fire and brimstone. It's also compassion, comfort, friendship, advice, et cetera, et cetera. And then when they came apart, the problem for Potemkin was that he was a man, and he wanted a woman to be a wife, or at least available, subservient in a sense. And she said in her letters and to him face to face, in a sense, the Russian version of, I understand what you're saying, sweetie, but I actually have an empire to run. And so I have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm not always going to be available at the snap of your fingers. And he became surly. He made scenes, walked out slamming the door, or walked into a room where she was having a meeting with her ministers or generals, wearing only a silk robe open at the front. I mean, he was trying to establish the fact that he owned her, and that became difficult. So they reached this agreement that he would go off and to the south and control that as her viceroy, her general, her conqueror, that they would both be free to take other partners. But he was always her faithful servant, I would say her beloved. But and their letters changed from passion to, I'd say great affection and relying on each other. For she was the empress. She could give him the army. She could supply the troops. She could give him orders. He would carry them out in his own way. It was a remarkable relationship.
And the letters still remained intimate because she went on to tell him about her other lovers, her favorites. And when they first met, she had just had the three lovers. He became the fourth, and he was extremely jealous and demanded to know who they were and what had happened, and she told him.
And she wrote that extraordinary letter. I don't know any letter from a sovereign, male or female, of explanation and apology, but it wasn't really apology. She said, look, if my first husband had been somebody who loved me and whom I could love, I would have been faithful to him forever. But he wasn't. And what has happened is a result of that. And I haven't had 15 lovers, as you accuse me of, but I think she says, you're my fifth. And that was over, you know, by then she was 45 years old. So that is not extraordinary, even today in our complicated world. But they were an extraordinary pair. You're absolutely right.
she had a dozen lovers over the course of her life, and we
we
meet them all. And,
a dozen lovers and one husband.
And one husband.
Well, maybe two.
Or maybe two. The Empress Elizabeth.
But that would mean one less lover.
You're right. He was no lover, the first husband.
No, certainly not.
Right.
No. It's so pathetic and so grotesque that it's almost sympathetic. You know, you remember that Peter came down with smallpox, and the ravages to his face and body were so grim that she said she couldn't recognize him.
And that was really when he turned on her, because he had hoped.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Because she said one word and then walked away. She was just horrified. But you remember also that smallpox was then a deadly disease, very prevalent, and that Catherine, when she heard that there was a British doctor who was inoculating people against smallpox by, you know, giving them a very mild case, she was the first person in Russia to do that. Her son, Paul, was the second. And within a couple of years, 20,000 Russians had been inoculated, and within her lifetime, 2 million. And she did this despite the fact that almost universally she was told, warned, pleaded with, for goodness sakes, don't do this. You're too precious to us. She went ahead.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. And today, going back to a couple of interviews that I recorded with Robert K. Massey almost exactly 8 years ago. He died this past week at the age of 90, and his biggest selling book was Nicholas and Alexandra. It was nearly 1,000 pages long. It sold more than 4.5 million copies and is regarded as one of the most popular historical studies ever published. In his account, Nicholas comes across not as stupid, weak, or bloodthirsty as he had been portrayed elsewhere, but as a worried parent. In reading up on Russian history and his research for Nicholas and Alexander, Mr. Massey became fascinated by Peter the Great, who had dragged feudal Russia towards modernity and turned a swamp into one of Europe's most beautiful cities, naming it after himself. But by his account, Mr. Massey could not find a biography that captured him, so he resolved to write one. It came out in 1980, Peter the Great, His Life and World, enlivened with anecdotes about Peter's love for his mistress, Catherine. Massey won the 1981 Pulitzer Prize for biography for that book. The Best of the Book Nook will continue right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, revisiting my 2011 interview with Robert K. Massey, who passed away just this past week.
You know, one thing I want to mention was that she was very, very astonishingly acute in managing of Russian foreign policy. Particularly one sort of footnote was her relationship with England, which was off and on again in terms of favor and hostility. But we Americans were finding our way to our own revolution during her reign.
Mm-hmm.
And when George III, the young king of England, at the behest of his ministers and military people, tried to rent 20,000 Russian soldiers, infantry, and 1,000 Cossacks to send to America, to North America, to deal with what the British ambassador said, His Majesty's distant American colonial subjects. This is George Washington and the Continental Army and so forth. Catherine refused.
And that could have changed history forever.
Well, it could have. So the English rented the Hessians instead, whom we heard of. But the idea for me and for you, I'm sure, of 20,000 Russians and 1,000 Cossacks rampaging over New York, New Jersey, down into the Virginia. It would have set back. You know, Russia is the one great power with whom the United States has never fought a war, and we had the Cold War, but that was because of Marxism and the Stalin's imperialistic ideological policies. But we've never fought the Russians. What legacy would we be carrying if the Russians had come here? The American Revolution came along, what was it, 10 years before the French Revolution. But she was not in favor of revolutions. Benjamin Franklin was in Paris during those years. She thought Franklin was a little pretentious. But remember the story, one of the stories that I think your listeners might be fascinated by was Catherine's relationship and use of John Paul Jones, the father of the American Navy. And I thought that was fascinating. I thought the troubles John Paul Jones got in with women in Russia was fascinating. I didn't know that, and I learned it from Samuel Eliot Morrison's book. But you're absolutely right. I have to get on the same side of the fence with you and just say her story was absolutely remarkable. It's why I was. That's why I spent 8 years writing this book.
A moment ago, you conjured up the image of 1,000 Cossacks rampaging through New Jersey, and we have a Cossack who is another really interesting character in this book because her husband, Peter III, had a very short reign. He's dead. Yet there were people who liked to pretend that they were Peter III, including this one particular Cossack who really got something going.
Well, 10 years after Catherine became empress and Peter was dead, and during the first war with Turkey, by the way, Turkey declared both of these wars, and Catherine won both of them, but the whole Russian army was involved in the Balkans, and still the Turkish armies were larger. But at that time, one of the Don Cossacks, horsemen, a man named Emelian Pugachev, deserted and wandered back across southern Russia, what is now Ukraine, to the area east of the Volga, which was really frontier, sort of with little frontier forts, the way the American West was in the 19th century. And he very soon found that there was a great resentment against the central government in St. Petersburg. There was resentment against tax collectors, against recruiting officers who would come into a village and take one or two from the village and forcibly take them into the army, et cetera, et cetera. And he took advantage of these resentments. And then he did the extraordinary thing of announcing to all and sundry that he was Tsar Peter III, returned from his travels 10 years later. Mm. And then now he was going to go back and remove his usurping wife, Catherine, from the throne, and then restore all of the ancient liberties, the old religion, the old manner of dress, to the people, and beginning with the people of this region where he raised this revolt. And so eventually he had gathered an army of 15, I think the extent of it was 20,000 people, all of them ill-equipped at the beginning. They had only their scythes from the fields and maybe a few weapons. This revolt at first spread by like wildfire. The whole revolt from start to finish only was a year, but it swept over that region of Russia. It was unopposed at first. Then Catherine's government sent a few detachments down to suppress it. They were defeated. The officers were slaughtered. And the revolt was really directed not only at the central government, but at the landowners and noblemen landowners who were living on their estates were murdered. Their wives and daughters were raped. Pugachev was bloody and cruel. He couldn't read or write. And then he did some strange sort of counter things. He named all of his principal lieutenants as counts and princes, gave them serfs, although he was supposedly leading a serf rebellion, and burned villages, burned manor houses, burned everything. It was a trail of devastation, and it got pretty far. Marching north, he reached Kazan, which was in the general area of central Russia, and there he was wholly defeated, and he fled south, pursued by detachments of the Russian army from the north. But the war with Turkey was then over, and the main Russian army, under its very good generals, was marching east to deal with him. And in the end, Catherine's generals had offered a reward for Pugachev, and his own aides turned on him, tied him up, and turned him over to the Russian commanders. He was put in an iron cage on a cart and hauled back to Moscow, where he was publicly executed. But that was the beginning of Catherine's somewhat definitive change from being what I guess you could loosely call a liberal, an Enlightenment figure and believer, to saying it's not going to be that easy to bring this kind of change I want to Russia when this kind of thing happens. And then these feelings in her were enhanced when the French Revolution came along and she heard what was happening in France. Then she really became frightened and clamped down even more and turned to a very conservative attitude towards not so much free speech, but books and materials brought in from Western Europe.
And the French Revolution took place near the end of her reign. And for readers who get to the end of the book, they'll discover a bizarre little piece of trivia about the guillotine. But we'll leave that for you to discover on your own.
I put that in with the gradual consent of my editor, because that had always interested me. It interests a lot of readers. Perhaps it shouldn't be there. It's only two or three pages of what happens when the guillotine is in operation. But
it certainly woke me up.
Yeah. Well, it wakes up some people. I haven't had any complaints yet from readers, but my editor, who's a great editor, Bob Loomis, felt I'm not sure this is necessarily necessary to a book about Catherine the Great. And I said, yeah, but I get to stick in some things that I'm interested in.
I noted that, and I guess that's why I mentioned it, because it's kind of a reward for those of us who have gotten to the end and we're saying, oh my, this happened in 1905, but it's relevant.
Yeah, that story.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure it's true, although the man has good credentials. Mm. And I say, my way of dealing with that kind of thing is to say that there is a story that, or there is even a story that, to show, people get interested in this kind of what really happened.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
The book is Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. Robert Massey wrote it, and it was a long time coming. What did you spend on this, about 8, 10 years?
No, 8, actually. That's short for me.
I'm
a very slow writer. Peter the Great took 12, and I wrote a couple of other books about World War One, which took a long time. But let me may I say just one thing?
Sure.
We talked about the fact that you and I were interested in these regions and their history and so forth. But I really feel that there's a lot in Catherine's life which is relevant today. Women can look to Catherine and what she achieved, the challenges she overcame, what she achieved as a woman. We've come partway to a better world for women. I mean, they are far more politically prominent and politically achieving than they were in the 18th century. I say in the book that I believe that Catherine the Great of Russia and Elizabeth I of England are the two, not only the two most significant women rulers in the age of monarchy, but two of the most significant rulers. I mean, certainly in Russian history, Catherine and Peter stand. He began this transformation of Russia into the West, and Catherine carried it along. All of the 19th century writers and musicians and the culture of Russia, which we all know now, was because Catherine made it possible. But I think that women today, I don't say that there are lessons in here, that would be presumptuous, but reading about her life and how she handled the difficult situation she was often in, they made me very happy to learn about and to write about. And I think women will be very interested in her. For example, how she stood up to the Empress when Catherine was nobody and could have been sent home on the next stagecoach. And how did she handle that? She came to the Empress and said, "You should send me home." And this was taking it head on. And Elizabeth, of course, didn't want to. She was just threatening Catherine. But that was the last thing she wanted. And the dialogue, which Catherine herself produces in her memoirs, is absolutely marvelous, I think. And I hope that women will read the book not just for a touch of exotic flavor or that thing, but for to see how one of their predecessors managed, I guess you could call it the glass ceiling.
Mm. That is one of the most powerful moments of the book, and it should be noted that her access to Empress Elizabeth was highly restricted. She wasn't supposed to talk to her or even see her.
No, Elizabeth. Once Elizabeth realized how intelligent Catherine was and how independent-minded, even though Catherine tried to control herself and be respectful, Elizabeth wanted to, as you say, wanted to limit their contact.
And so she had the ultimate gambit, and that was where it all turned when she said, "Send me home."
Yeah, and Elizabeth said, "Why would I send you home? Why do you want to go home?" And Catherine said, "Because I have failed so miserably to please your Imperial Majesty." Well, what is the Empress going to say to that?
Mm. She was truly brilliant. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you today.
Well, and for me also.
And that was Robert K. Massey, recorded almost exactly 8 years ago, and bringing you the Best of the Book Nook today as we look back at that interview and remember Robert Massey, who died this past week at the age of 90. And he wrote about other things. He wrote about naval history, and he was very good with quotes. He had a wonderful ear for quotations, and one of them in one of his Navy books was from Winston Churchill, who was then the First Lord of the Admiralty, saying in 1912, "If we win the big battle in the decisive theater, we can put everything else straight afterwards. If we lose it, there will not be any afterwards." I can just imagine Winston saying that. And Robert Massey was a gentleman and a scholar. He won the Pulitzer Prize. He sold millions of books. And for the best of the Book Nook, remembering Robert K. Massey, I am Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.